This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is Joyce Goh. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning, Han.
All right, keeping you company ahead of the three-day weekend. Oh, so excited. Also, if you are keeping score, we are 2 weeks away from the premiere of the next Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, and also 25 days away from Christmas. I'm sure you're counting down to that, Joyce.
Very much. And New Year.
And any big plans for the year end?
Not really. Just, traveling with the kids for a family, a relative's wedding. But we'll be back for Christmas and New Year.
Because it's all about the family, eh?
How about yourself?
Nope, just going to be really chill and hang out in the good old Klang Valley. Yeah, keeping our BFM listeners company, I think. I like to think so. Got to earn my paycheck. All right, folks, here's a look at some news while Malaysians slept. So U.S. President Donald Trump has retweeted some anti-Muslim videos, which has earned him a rebuke from U.K. Prime Minister Theresa May. The videos were initially tweeted by a British far-right group. Theresa May's official spokesman said it was wrong for the president to have done this. But the White House responded saying, quote, "These are real threats that we have to talk about. Whether it's a real video, the threat is real."
You mean he doesn't care if the video is real? He just pushes out whatever that he thinks is real.
Yeah,
you know, is it alternative facts?
I guess in the past there have been calls for there to be a babysitter for Donald Trump, especially in the wee hours of the morning. You know, when he retweets stuff like that.
Yeah. He has like 43.6 million Twitter followers, right? And you would think that you'll think a bit more about what you're tweeting out there, right?
Yeah, well, there's an article in the BBC that says that this kind of online behavior fits a certain pattern. You can go check that out. Moving along really quickly, NBC, US TV network NBC, has fired a popular TV host, Matt Lauer, after complaints about inappropriate sexual behavior. So the network is responding to a complaint filed by an employee about said inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace. And so he is the latest in a string of high-profile media personalities, not just in Hollywood in film, but also in TV as well.
Yes.
You had Bill O'Reilly recently. I think
Charlie Rose.
Yep.
And then a couple of top news people, journalists, right?
Yeah. So Matt Lauer being the latest high-profile case there. Now, onto a bit of a strange news. You've got a Bosnian war criminal who has died after taking poison in court. So this war criminal was in court on trial during an appeal hearing in The Hague. And he was sentenced for crimes in the city of Mostar during the Bosnian War from 92 to 95. And when his 20-year jail term was upheld, he then drank from a bottle and
right there in court?
Yeah, right there in the court. And then he died, was declared dead on the way to the hospital.
Oh.
Yeah, quite morbid there. And so now that UN courtroom has been seen, what is now declared a crime scene. Yeah, quite the twist to the proceedings over there, and quite a twist to the morning so far that we're having right now. Still, I guess on a more lighter note, so have you been following the the upcoming royal wedding?
Yes.
Yeah? So
yes.
Are you excited about that?
Yeah, I am very much.
So,
who isn't? Are you not?
Well,
excited?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a big fan of... I guess I'm more interested in the first royal, the older brother.
But this is such a fairy tale. They met on a blind date.
Yeah.
After that, they went on after a month, they went to Botswana to have a date under the stars. And then now they're getting married.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm not so much a romantic then, I guess. They're starting to lose interest. My interest in this is supposed to wane right now. But still, we're learning more about Meghan, or Meghan Markle. So she's been written out of a Suits or that TV show about a year ago. So it's quite interesting to see how she's becoming this bigger star than she was in her TV show Suits.
And I think people are accepting this. It's amazing how, because she's older than him by 3 years, and she's divorced.
Age is just a number.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But they're accepting. I mean, everyone's accepting this. That I mean, even the British people, because you know how there was a time when if you're divorced, they will not accept.
Taboo.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But now they're accepting it.
Okay. Well, coming up in just a bit, we'll be taking a look at gifts and what it could mean as we enter the season of giving. That's coming up right here on BFM 89.9. That was the specials with Nightclub right here on BFM 89.9, where the party is just getting started. I am Tan Chung Hai, and with me is Joyce Goh, keeping you company here. So Indonesian President Joko Widodo, or popularly known as Jokowi, is known for his love of heavy metal. And so with Denmark Prime Minister Lars Rasmussen, clearly took note of this little piece of information and added a personal touch to the usually conservative gift exchange between leaders during official visits. The Danish Prime Minister visited Indonesia there, and he gave Jokowi a special box set of Metallica's Master of Puppets, which was signed by the band's drummer Lars Ulrich, who was born in Denmark. Which then warrants this discussion here, right? You know, should we start pushing the envelope when it comes to gift giving, or should we stay rather conservative? You know, especially when we enter this season of gift exchanges here, Joyce.
I think it's very thoughtful. It was a very thoughtful move on his side, and it's nice. I mean, it looks like he's done his research. He knows what the person he's giving the gift to likes. I like that. I mean, for me, if I were to receive a gift, if the person did some research and if it's personalized, that's one of the things as well that I look for. Like, if I'm buying someone a gift, if a friend or a close friend, I would try and get something personalized, something that they like.
Yeah, certainly. Now, I'm not much of a gift-giving person. You know, growing up with eight other siblings, if you had to exchange gifts all year long, you'll be broke, essentially, right? So, you know, when it comes to, say, someone whom you may not know, like, say, for example, you've got, even here at BFM, we've got a
Secret Santa.
There we go.
Yes, looking forward to that.
Okay, now, you may not know the other person as well as, say, somebody, you know, on the morning run team, right? So what are some rule of thumbs that you go by, you know? And okay, before the show, there was this discussion about how it's easier to get gifts for females versus males.
But if you're a guy, wouldn't you know what to get for a guy?
I have no idea. I'm terrible. I'm hopeless when it comes to buying gifts.
I get a good friend to help you. That's what my husband does. Get me to help him.
Discuss ideas. I guess it's at the risk of sounding sexist here, it's a guy thing. Like, I'm just hopeless when it comes to trying to figure out gifts for other people, though. So help me out here, Joyce.
But it depends on who you're buying it for, girl or guy?
A guy. Okay.
Okay.
It's another guy.
Okay. A book. No?
A book?
You think?
Really?
Does he like?
Well, that's the thing. So I don't know, right?
See?
So unless if you have that, you know, like Lars Rasmussen employee, you know, he used that bit of trivia on Jokowi, and then you can leverage on that, right?
You can get to know the person. Maybe that's what Secret Santa is about.
Well, yeah.
You can get to know the person and then find out what the person likes. Getting to know your colleague.
Yeah.
That's what Secret Santa thing is about in an office, right?
See, but it'd be really weird. I think it'd be a giveaway, right? If I've barely spoken to this person
and
I start cozying up. Hey, so what do you like? What kind of stuff do you like?
Get to know the person. Hey, so what's happening today? Right. So, how's the show today? Yeah. What's happening? And
that's a good point. Well done there, Joyce. But okay, so I mean, just again, capo. Well, now again, broadly speaking, though, are there some go-to items? Like, what are your top three items, say for males or females, that you can just go in a jiffy?
I like jewelry, accessories.
Jewelry.
Yeah, I like to get them accessories.
Well, that's way out of my budget, lah. Jewelry, really?
Yeah, there are stuff. I got earrings for the Secret Santa person. Here.
Okay, I hear coupons. Oh no, not coupons. So sorry. gift cards to Sephora and these makeup places. That's a
gift
winner,
cards.
Right?
Okay.
Is that a winner?
It depends on the girl.
Oh, man. See, this is where it gets so convoluted now, isn't it? Yeah.
For guys, shirts.
Ah,
ties.
Shirts. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, shirts, ties.
Pretty good.
That's what I like to get.
All right.
Yeah.
And do you have to put a lot of thought into it? Have you found that from your experience?
For guys?
Yeah. Or for anyone, really?
Yeah, sometimes you think about the person that you're gifting to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And see what they like. And then from there, what you could do is you can get a notebook and personalize it.
That sounds like a lot of work.
No, it's not.
A lot of time. What do you mean by personalize it? Make it into...
You can emboss the person's initials on it.
Yeah, that sounds like too much work. Oh my gosh.
Well, coming back to Jokowi, this thing about gift and politicians, they have to report that, right? So this is what is happening in Indonesia. He will have to report that to the Corruption Eradication Commission. And then they will decide whether the president should return the gift or he can keep it.
Well, I think he should keep it, right?
Yeah, I think he should.
So now, where do you draw the line between, say, you know, a bribe and a well-intended gift, right? Because especially, you know, with us here in the media, you know, we have to maintain our objectivity. And so, well, here at BFM, we have the policy, right, when in terms of, you know, what we may receive from outside parties. So
you have
you know,
to declare it.
Right, you have to declare it and just like joke away, right? But, you know, I guess in a very relational, heavy culture like Malaysia, whereby exchange of gifts is so common, especially in the corporate world as well, does that line get blurred between a gift and a bribe?
Yeah, this way there should be, in the corporate world or wherever you're working at, there should be a code of conduct where they tell you, you know, you have to declare. So MACC actually has, when we were working on the story, MACC, the producers, found this website, a link in MACC that it gives this guidelines on gift inquiry. So what is the definition of a gift? Is giving the gift of a hamper of small value perceived as a bribe? Can a civil servant receive gifts during festive season? So they have all these Q&As. That's quite interesting.
So what does it say? Is a
okay,
hamper
so what
a
do you
bribe?
Want to know?
What
okay,
is a hamper,
a hamper
bribe?
Bribe? Accepting or giving gifts of any amount of value amounting to a corruption offence in situations that an individual receives or gives such gifts from a supplier. This is the hamper that the individual has an official dealing with. So it looks like it's
a bribe.
Perceived as
right,
a bribe.
So no hampers if you've got direct business
dealings
with
the person.
Yeah, they
even ask about, like, can a civil servant receive gifts during festive season? So it says public officers are prohibited from accepting gifts in any form, such as hampers, mandarin oranges, ang pao packets, and any other forms of gifts from any person that is associated with the official duties of the officer.
Yeah, well, that takes just the fun out of the whole season
mandarin
of giving,
oranges,
right?
Mandarin oranges is cannot.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it just takes the fun out of, you know, the intentions, right? If they are well-placed intentions, like with the Danish Prime Minister to Jokowi, you know, then why shouldn't that just be, you know, as it is, just taken at face value, right? As opposed to, you know, suspecting of these hidden agendas.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the argument here would be that Indonesia might have preferential treatment for the Danes, you know, if there's any.
Well, as long as it's declared, and then the committee will decide whether he can keep it on. I think that's fair.
Yeah, sure enough. Okay, it's coming up to 16 minutes past 6 a.m. here on BFM 89.9. Coming up, we've got the song from Metallica called I Disappear on BFM 89.9. 22 minutes past 6 a.m. on this lovely Thursday, November 30th, the day just before our three-day weekend. Certainly excited for that. Perhaps not so excited about the future, though, at least in terms of our job prospects, because according to a study by McKinsey and Co., so as many as 800 million workers worldwide may lose their jobs to robots or automation by the year 2030. Now, 800 million, that's equivalent to over a fifth of today's global labor force.
That's so scary, Han. And the report covers 46 nations, so it's really big, and more than 800 occupations. And machine operators, fast food workers, and back office employees are among those who will be most affected if automation spreads quickly through the workplace. That is what the study has found. This is the latest. I mean, we've been talking about AI, robots, the robots are coming, you know, they're going to take over our jobs. We're just talking about it. It's all in the headlines, but now they have a figure and it's huge. It's 800 million worldwide.
Right. So in the next 3 minutes or so, let's try and find a solution then for the human in 3 minutes, because we're efficient like that. So what are there any proposals? Does this study offer any solutions to, you know, how we might stem this tide? Or is it just a defeatist approach? You know, the robots are coming. We can't do anything about it.
Well, they're saying that we have to try and learn new skills. That's part of the research that they found. Like, you know, we're all going to have to change and learn to do new things over time. That's
new things like learn to bow down to the robot overlords. Is that what it is? What kind of new skills? So, like, whether or not we have the kind of will, right, to upskill ourselves in order to, you know, fend off this onslaught, right?
Yeah, that's right. So well, there are some things that they can look at. Well, the good news is for those displaced is that there will be jobs for them to transition into. Although in many cases, they're going to have to learn new skills to do the work. So those jobs will include like healthcare providers for aging populations, technology specialists, and even gardening, like gardeners.
Gardening?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, okay. Well, perhaps you would think that there's a robot, gardening robot that's been developed out there somewhere.
Maybe not yet.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, though, something else that's being considered is the idea of UBI, that's Universal Basic Income, whereby, you know, because a huge portion of the human workforce will no longer be able to work, mm-hmm. so governments are then given, you know, governments are then giving their citizens a universal basic income. There's an amount which is enough to sustain the individual, and that should be able to, you know, like basically let them continue living life mm-hmm. without necessarily finding some kind of income. Like, would that be appealing to you, you think?
But it will not be challenging. So every day they don't go to work? But
no work. Oh. Yeah, so you don't have to work, but you can just...
government is so good?
Well, so Finland is experimenting with it right now. There are other Scandinavian economies. Even Canada is talking about it. They have implemented it to some degree in Saudi Arabia, for example. And I understand other economies, including Malaysia, are actively, you know, are pursuing that idea as well. So will this be appealing to you? Because while you don't have a job, one would think that you'd be robbed of, say, the sense of purpose. You know, can you find purpose beyond your workplace, beyond your job?
Yeah, my kids.
Ah, well done. But then you're going to have kids, then bring them into a world with significantly fewer jobs.
That's a scary thought, I must say. So that's why a lot of parents, that's definitely on our minds. And you know, everything's changing. That's why you have stuff like coding classes and all that. You're trying to figure out, right? You're trying to prep them for the future, because you know that when the future comes, jobs, the whole landscape for jobs would have changed entirely.
So are you giving your kids gardening classes then?
Yeah, perhaps I should, according to this article, right? Because McKinsey is saying also that up to 375 million individuals, that's 14% of all workers globally, may need to find a new job in a new sector entirely, right? And that is huge. And in Japan, almost half the workforce may need to reskill themselves.
Right. And for people like you and I, you know, you would think that this disruption is going to come sooner rather than later, mm-hmm. right? In a matter of years. And we'll still be well within the working age,
yes.
one would think, these predictions are true. But, well, you say hopefully, but you know, if it disrupts us while we are mid-career, you know, do you think we'll have enough?
This is why you need to reskill. And look for things to do. Maybe pick up fishing, gardening.
Yeah, well, I'd rather take the Beach Boys' approach. This next song is called Don't Worry, Baby. We just let the robots know, like, figure it out themselves, and I think we'll be fine. That's coming up next right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Tell Me What's On Your Mind by Ala Las. Right here on The Morning Run, I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is Joyce Goh, keeping you company. It's coming up to 41 minutes past 6 a.m. on this Thursday, November 30th. And you can always tell us what's on your mind by tweeting us at BFM Radio or send us a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Tell us what's on your mind, especially when it comes to durians getting a whole lot more expensive. Now, this comes as the value of China's fresh imports of durians has climbed at an average of 26% per year over the last 10 years or so. It has reached over 1 billion US dollars in 2016, and that's according to UN data. You got Thailand, which is dominating the market, but Malaysian politicians are also counting on durian diplomacy to expand access beyond frozen fruit pulp. There seems to be like a push and pull factor here. On one hand, durian is very much beloved by Malaysians, but do you love durians more, and specifically cheaper durians, or do you love making money more? I guess that's the idea.
Can we have both?
Well, no? Can we have both?
Well, definitely has affected durian prices, the China demand. I mean, look at what... I remember those days when kampong durians, you can get them 3 for 10 ringgit. I cannot find them. Like anywhere now.
Yeah,
I tried. Do you eat durian?
Not really.
Oh,
yeah,
I see. Obviously,
see,
yeah.
So you're losing me here.
Yeah, like, I love durian.
So what's that got to do with the price of cheese? I'm like, eh, so what?
Yeah, so definitely the price of durian has gone up exponentially. And you cannot find, it's like just a box with like maybe 5 seeds of durian. They can charge for like 50, depending on what grade or whatever, right? It can go from 50, 60, 70. It can go up so much and it's crazy. Never before, I do not remember it being so expensive.
But this is basic economics here, right? Because there's obviously a lot bigger demand out of China there. Mm-hmm. Because apparently a Malaysian durian festival held in Nanning, that's in southern China, earlier this month, had about 165,000 people lining up just to taste thawed durian samples, specifically the Musang King variety. You know, 165,000, you know, clogging up a certain area sounds like a typical weekend in SS15 or Taipan or something over there in Subang.
Yeah, I remember our Deputy Minister for International Trade and Industry said earlier that durians and durian-based products are among the most searched items in China on e-commerce site Alibaba.com.
Right.
That's interesting. That's how much they love the fruit.
Right. So again, you know, given how much Chinese people over there in mainland China are loving durians, mm-hmm. right? You know, and we obviously cannot compete in terms of demand. Mm-hmm. Should we just say, you know, hands up, okay, fine, the Chinese want it, they're going to pay a higher price, you know, we should sell it to them? Or should we have some kind of protectionist policies around durians?
Maybe you should. Maybe they could do supply for export market and also supply for local market.
But there's not enough. There aren't enough.
Yeah,
trees,
I mean they
right?
can work to. Yeah, then there's not enough. We can work towards that. But apparently now there's more supply now. From what I heard last weekend,
really,
that the price has come down a bit, according to my durian checks.
Yeah. Durian channel checks.
Yeah. Do you know that a durian, right, for about five pieces in China, a single piece may cost up to 100 yuan. That's like 15 USD.
Wow. Okay.
That's quite pricey, yeah.
Yeah. But then, on the other hand, you've got the Chinese who are not just taking up the fruit, but they're also coming in and taking up whole durian plantations as well. So depending on the location and accessibility, a farm with six-year-old trees goes for about 400,000 ringgit per hectare. Whilst those with mature trees, that's 10 to 12 years old, those can command at least double that. And that's according to a real estate agent by the name of Eric Lau. So, you know, how can you compete though,
yeah,
against
the China money, right?
Right. You know, so I guess, are we willing to give up more money for our love for durians? Is that something?
It looks like it's heading that way.
Yeah. Are you okay with that?
Well, no choice, right? It's gone up from, can you imagine, 3 durians for like 10 ringgit? Now it's like, you can't even get one for like 50 ringgit, depending on what kind of durian that is. And they weigh it by the whole durian.
Okay.
It's not like they take it out, because they go by weight, right? So it's not like they open the durian first and then they weigh the seed. No, they weigh the whole durian. So with the thorns, everything.
So you take on the risk of perhaps there not being as many.
Yeah, you do not know. Yeah, inside how many seeds there will be. That it's come to that now.
Well, it sounds like a Forrest Gump a quote there, you know, life's like a durian, you know, you don't know what
you're going to get.
Yeah, until you open it. I totally butchered that. I'm sorry. It's coming up to 46 minutes past 6 a.m. here on The Morning Run. We'll be back with more right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Can I Get a Witness by Marvin Gaye, right here on The Morning Run. 50 minutes past 6 a.m. It's Thursday, November 30th. I'm Han and we've got Joyce in the studio as well. So our next story looks at the role of freedom of expression in the development of a nation. Former Chief Justice Mohamed Zaidin Abdullah has called for a culture of dialogue and freedom of expression that allows citizens to speak out without having the risk of dubious laws clamping down on them.
He said freedom of expression and dissenting voices should not be stifled because that would be akin to a suppression of legitimate voices, leading to zero checks and balances.
All right, so this was a point similarly made by Peter Grest, a former journalist with Al Jazeera. Now, Peter made the headlines around the world for being charged by Egyptian authorities for spreading false news and aiding the banned Muslim Brotherhood organization. So BFM presenter Umapagan Apikepren spoke with Peter earlier this year. Now, in the interview, Peter talked about the constant need for free speech and how that does not mean that it causes hate and division. Here's what he said.
You need to constantly challenge the authorities. You need to ask, and not this isn't about undermining them. The most fundamental point about free debate is the contest of ideas. So if a government is proposing a policy, then it's the media's job to ask whether this is the best possible policy, to hold it up to scrutiny, to ask other, to check with other experts, to see if the basis of the policy is sound, to see whether there are other better alternatives, to throw that open for public discussion. And if the policy is a good one, then it'll survive that scrutiny. And governments shouldn't be afraid of that sort of thing. They should welcome it because it means that the government works well. Here's something that people seem to forget all too often. We vote for politicians. They work for us. We are their employers because they're public servants. And as public servants, they're accountable to the voters, to the public, the people that put them in power. And therefore, they have a duty to answer questions from their employer. And as the media, it's our job to ask those questions on behalf of the public.
And that was an excerpt from our interview with Peter Grester, former Al Jazeera journalist, driving the point of freedom of speech home. Now, you can listen to the full interview by downloading the BFM app, available on the Apple App Store and Google Play.
At the same time, there's no denying that public dissent may cause friction and divide. So we spoke to lawyer Ann Surendran from Lawyers for Liberty and asked him how citizens can learn to identify the difference between free speech and the promotion of hate and division.
I think in the first place, the real test or problem that we face is speech that incites or calls for violence. Any other speech, for example, what is called hate speech, is legal. In other words, in a free society, we should be able to tolerate even speech that seems offensive to other people, because that is one of the risks of living in a free country, in a society that values freedom of speech. But at the same time, of course, citizens should avoid hate speech or objectionable speech of that nature. And it is not very difficult. You know, attacking a particular race or a particular religion or a particular disability, all these are clearly hate speech, which I think any citizen with some common sense should be able to differentiate, you know, from any other type of free speech.
That was Ann Surendran from Lawyers for Liberty sharing his views on how the difference between hate and free speech can easily be identifiable.
So he calls that a risk, right? You know, on one hand, if you are to tolerate free speech, that risks being exposed to speech that or ideas that totally goes against your values, you know, be it religious, moral, and political, etc., right? Mm-hmm. So obviously we do not have that here in Malaysia, and we're having this discussion just hours after US President Donald Trump retweeted some videos that appear to have anti-Muslim sentiments, right?
Yeah, that he wasn't even sure whether the videos were for real or not.
Right, you know, and the White House has since then said that the threats are real, even though the videos may not be mm-hmm. real, and Theresa May, UK Prime Minister, has rebuked him. Right, so you know, do we really want this idea of free speech here? You know, like, do we really want it in its entirety, or should there be limits to free speech?
Yeah, there should be. I mean, when it comes to the promotion of hate and division, definitely there should be limits to that, right? Mm. As what the lawyer was talking about earlier, and Surendran, right? And recently, former Chief Justice Mohammad Zaidin Abdullah has called for a culture of dialogue and freedom of expression that allows citizens to speak out without having the risk of like dubious laws clamping down on them. But I guess there should be a limit when it comes to like promoting hate and dissent.
Well, that's an argument that continues on here in Malaysian society, certainly here on BFM as well. Right now we've got Modest Mouse with Float On right here on The Morning Run. BFM 89.9. It's 8 minutes past 7 a.m. on this Thursday, November 30th, just ahead of the three-day weekend. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is Melissa Idris. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Right now, tomorrow, December 1st, is World AIDS Day, aimed at promoting awareness and providing support for patients and families living with the disease. Now, we've made some good progress in terms of treatment and prevention in AIDS here in Malaysia, especially among drug users. However, fighting the stigma that surrounds the disease, now that remains an uphill task.
Yeah, case in point, Han, is the Seed Foundation. They've come out to hit out at a religious motivational speaker for making insensitive remarks about people living with HIV during a World AIDS Day event, which was organized by the Health Ministry, and that was last weekend. So the Seed Foundation said that Ustaza Dr. Robia K. Hamza made some extremely discriminatory comments about marginalized communities affected by HIV, which were unsubstantiated and downright damaging.
That's right. So BFM went to the source of the story and spoke to Nisha Ayub, who is the co-founder of the Seed Foundation. We asked how she reacted to the remarks.
Of course, definitely. I was extremely shocked. And, you know, the first thing when I heard the whole conversation that this so-called motivational doctor was speaking, my immediate reaction was those people are thinking about talking about HIV/AIDS prevention awareness and everything. At the same time, you are degrading and you are stigmatizing the community. You know, for her to be up there and basically being a so-called a motivational speaker on a World AIDS Day awareness program in the public to degrade this community, my biggest question is, where is the stand of the Ministry of Health? This year itself, the team for World AIDS Day is access to medication and treatment, you know, and they talk about human rights. And then at the same time, you are having such people, you know, trying to make the community feel bad about themselves. And not just that, giving negative remarks to the public in regards to the community that eventually will create more fear and at the same time will degrade the community, right? How would you expect the community to come to get those access to help when you yourself create that kind of discriminative environment for such a marginalized community? You know, and this is just not about transgender community, but it's about overall people living with HIV/AIDS because as you're aware, that HIV/AIDS does not discriminate one's gender or sexuality or whatsoever, right? But yet again, you have this kind of mentality of so-called professionals or motivational speakers being invited to be on stage.
And we also asked her what was worse, the fact that these flippant remarks were made or the fact that the authorities hadn't come out and said anything against it?
For me, honestly, as I've been pinpointing from the beginning, is that I will ask the MOH and Malaysian Council to further investigate, because I believe it's their responsibility. Even though I was told that this is a state event, right, done in Setia One, but whatever it is, as the main source of doing HIV/AIDS program, they need to be responsible on the message that they brought up to the public in general. And that event is about World AIDS Day. You know, you shouldn't be talking about religion. You shouldn't be talking about your personal belief. You should be talking about creating more awareness and creating more education and information at the same time to reduce stigma towards people living with HIV/AIDS.
That was Nisha Ayub, the co-founder of Seed Foundation. So I thought some of the comments that she made were really quite interesting, because at that event, I mean, you should be talking about how to, I guess, provide more access for medication for the for people living with AIDS and HIV, not kind of making them feel bad about the community feel bad, right?
Right. I think the main point that was conveyed was, you know, try to go against the stigma of it, right? You know, trying to make sure there is a welcoming enough environment whereby those who are suffering from AIDS, you know, those in their community can then seek better access to treatment, and other services that the Ministry of Health may be providing.
You know, I struggled because I thought, should I repeat what Ustaza Dr. Robia said about the HIV, the people living with HIV? And I came to the decision that I really wouldn't. I wouldn't repeat these discriminatory comments that she made, because that is what will stick, right? Mm. So they're not true. They're unsubstantiated. In fact, they're downright false. So what I will do is repeat the positive trends of tackling the AIDS epidemic here in Malaysia. If you do want to know, a very low percentage of transgender people have been found in new HIV cases, 5.6%. So I think that busts the myth that transgender people are one of the higher percentage when it comes to HIV transmission.
Yeah, certainly. But also, while giving a balanced approach, I'd like to draw your attention to a breakfast grill that we had back in August, August 23rd. You can check out that podcast via the BFM app, available on the Google Play Store and also the Apple App Store, titled "Why Don't You Put on a Condom?" The Sharad spoke to Dr. Anita Sulaiman, head of HIV STI at the Ministry of Health, and also Bhaktia Talha, president of the Malaysian AIDS Council, because back in July, there was actually this report from the UN which shows that Malaysia, together with 9 other countries, we are one of 10 that account for over 95% of all new HIV infections in the Asia-Pacific region. So it's about creating awareness. Mm. It's also, at the same time, it is not a mutually exclusive message here, whereby on one hand, you create awareness, you know, it is a problem that has to be tackled, but at the same time, also reducing the stigma that, you know, society has to play a part as well in making sure that we have this conducive environment where, you know, those suffering from AIDS can seek the treatment that they need.
Well, do you know that that most, so the data showed that 83% of HIV cases were sexually transmitted. So it's not so much about drug use anymore. Mm. It's about sexually transmitted, it being a sexually transmitted disease. And that's why the education awareness that you're talking about, Han, is so important, because, you know, things like sex education and you know, understanding sexual protection, using protection, what that means, all that goes a long way in stopping the spread of sexually transmitted HIV cases.
So keep in mind, folks, December 1st is World AIDS Day.
Tomorrow,
Tomorrow, that's right. Also the start of our 3-day weekend. coming up in just a bit, folks, we'll look at the front pages of the local papers right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.